stock. Start investing now, SushiCare stock. It on Nikkei Stock Exchange. Waxes, other rappers, Wayne. Best investment, make my day. Corporation SushiCare.
Squeaky is walking straight uphill, paralleling a fresh motorcycle track that is cut deeply into the loose yellow soil. It consists of a deep, wide track with a narrower one that runs parallel, a couple of feet to the right. The track gets deeper the farther up they go, deeper and darker. It looks less and less like a motorcycle rut in loose dirt, and more like a drainage ditch for some sinister black effluent.
Coming to America now. Rappers trying to start a row. Say, stay in Japan, please listen. We can't handle competition. U.S. rappers booing and hissing. Ask for rap protectionism. They are afraid of SushiCare, cause their audience go away. He got chill financial backing, giving those U.S. rappers a smacking. SushiCare concert machine, fast, efficient, super clean, run like clockwork in a watch, kick old rappers in the crutch.
One of the enforcers up the hill is carrying a flashlight. As he moves, it sweeps across the ground at a flat angle, briefly illuminating the ground like a searchlight. For an instant, the light shines into the motorcycle rut, and Hiro perceives that it has become a river of bright red oxygenated blood.
He learned English, total immersion, English-Japanese be merging into super combination, so can have fans in every nation. Hong Kong, they speak English too. Yearn of rappers, just like you. Anglophones who live down under, sooner or later, start to wonder when they get their own rap star, tired of rappers from afar.
Lagos is lying on the ground, sprawled across the tire track. He has been split open like a salmon, with a single, smooth-edged cut that begins at his anus and runs up his belly, through the middle of his sternum, all the way up to the point of his jaw. It's not just a superficial slash. It appears to go all the way to his spine in some places. The black nylon straps that hold his computer system to his body have been neatly cut where they cross the midline, and half of the stuff has fallen off into the dust.
So I will get big radio traffic when you look at demographic. SushiCare research statistic make big future look ballistic. Speed of SushiCare growth stock put U.S. rappers into shock.
Jason Breckenridge wears a terracotta blazer. It is the color of Sicily. Jason Breckenridge has never been to Sicily. He may get to go there someday as a premium. In order to get the free cruise to Sicily, Jason has to accumulate 10,000 Gumbara points. He begins this quest in a favorable position. By opening up his own Nova Sicilia franchise, he started out with an automatic 3,333 points in the Gumbara Point Bank. Add to that a one-time-only citizenship bonus of 500 points, and the balance is starting to look pretty good. The number is stored in the big computer in Brooklyn. Jason grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago, one of the most highly franchised regions in the country. He attended the University of Illinois Business School, racking up a GPA of 2.9567, and did a senior thesis called The Interaction of the Ethnographic, Financial, and Paramilitary Dimensions of Competition in Certain Markets. This was a case study of turf struggle between Nova Sicilia and Narcolombia franchises in his old neighborhood in Aurora. Enrique Cortesar ran the failing Narcolombia franchise upon which Jason had hinged his argument. Jason interviewed him several times over the phone, briefly, but never saw Mr. Cortesar face to face. Mr. Cortesar celebrated Jason's graduation by firebombing the Breckenridge's Omni Horizon van in a parking lot and then firing 11 clips of automatic rifle ammunition through the front wall of their house. Fortunately, Mr. Caruso, who ran the local string of Nova Sicilia franchulates that was in the process of beating the pants off of Enrique Cortazar, got wind of these attacks before they happened, probably by intercepting signal intelligence from Mr. Cortazar's fleet of poorly secured cellular phones and CB radios. He was able to warn Jason's family in time, so that when all those bullets flew through their house in the middle of the night, they were enjoying a complimentary champagne in an old Cecilia inn 5 miles down Highway 96. Naturally, when the B school held its end-of-the-year job fair, Jason made a point of swinging by the Nova Sicilia booth to thank Mr. Caruso for saving everyone in his family from certain death.
"Hey, you know, it was just like a neighbor kind of thing, you know, JC boy," Mr. Caruso said, whacking Jason across the shoulder blades and squeezing his deltoids, which were the size of cantaloupes.
Jason did not hit the steroids as hard as he had when he was 15, but he was still in great shape. Mr. Caruso was from New York. He had one of the most popular booths at the job fair. It was being held in a big exhibition space in the Union. The hall had been done up with an imaginary street pattern. Two highways divided it up into quadrants, and all the franchise companies and nationalities had their booths along the highways. Burb Claves and other companies had booths hidden among the suburban streets within the quadrants. Mr. Caruso's Nova Sicilia booth was right at the intersection of the two highways. Dozens of scrubby B-school grads were lined up there, waiting to interview. But Mr. Caruso noticed Jason standing in line and went right up and plucked him out of line and grabbed his deltoids. All the other B-school grads stared at Jason enviously. That made Jason feel good, really special. That was the feeling he got about Nova Sicilia, personalized attention.
"Well, I was going to interview here, of course, and at Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, because I'm real interested in high-tech," Jason said,
in response to Mr. Caruso's fatherly questioning. Mr. Caruso gave him an especially hard squeeze. His voice said that he was painfully surprised, but that he didn't necessarily think any less of Jason for it. Not yet, anyway.
"Hong Kong! What would a smart white kid like you want with a fucking nip operation?"
"Well, technically they're not nips, which is short for Nipponese," Jason said. "Hong Kong is predominantly Cantonese."
"They're all nips," Mr. Caruso said. "And you know why I say that? Not because I'm a fucking racist, because I'm not. Because to them, to those people, you know, the nips, we're all foreign devils. That's what they call us, foreign devils. How do you like that?"
Jason just laughed appreciatively.
"After all the good things we did for them. But here in America, JC boy, we're all foreign devils, ain't we? We all came from someplace, except for the fucking Indians. You ain't gonna interview over at the Lakota Nation, are you?"
"No, sir, Mr. Caruso," Jason said.
"Good thinking. I agree with that. I'm getting away from my main point, which is that since we all have our own unique ethnic and cultural identities, we have to get a job with an organization that uniquely respects and seeks to preserve those distinctive identities, forging them together into a functioning whole, you know?"
"Yes, I see your point, Mr. Caruso," Jason said.
By this point, Mr. Caruso had led him some distance away and was strolling with him down one of the metaphorical highways of opportunity.
"Now, can you think of some business organizations that fill that fucking bill, JC boy?"
"Well,
not fucking Hong Kong. That's for white people who want to be Japs but can't. Did you know that? You don't want to be a Jap, do you?"
"Ha, ha, no, sir, Mr. Caruso."
"You know what I heard?"
Mr. Caruso let go of Jason, turned and stood close to him, chest to chest, his cigar zinging past Jason's ear like a flaming arrow as he gesticulated. This was a confidential portion of the chat, a little anecdote between the two men.
"In Japan, if you screw up, you gotta cut off one of your fingers. Chop. Just like that. Honest to God. You don't believe me?"
"I believe you. But that's not all of Japan, sir. Just in the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia."
Mr. Caruso threw back his head and laughed, put his arm around Jason's shoulders again.
"You know, I like you, Jason. I really do," he said. "The Japanese mafia. Tell me something, Jason. You ever hear anyone describe our thing as the Sicilian Yakuza? Huh?
Jason laughed.
No, sir. You know why that is? You know?
Mr. Caruso had come to the serious, meaningful part of his speech.
Why is that, sir?
Mr. Caruso wheeled Jason around so that both of them were staring down the length of the highway to the tall effigy of Uncle Enzo standing above the intersection like the Statue of Liberty.
"'Cause there's only one, son. Only one. And you could be a part of it.
But it's so competitive.
What? Listen to this. You got a 3-point grade average. You're gonna kick butt, son."
Mr. Caruso, like any other franchisee, had access to TurfNet, the multiple listing service that Nova Sicilia used to keep track of what it called opportunity zones. He took Jason back to the booth, right past all those poor dorks waiting in line. Jason really liked that. And signed onto the network. All Jason had to do was pick out a region.
"I have an uncle who owns a car dealership in Southern California," Jason said. "And I know that's a rapidly expanding area and..." "Plenty of opportunity zones," Mr. Caruso said, pounding away on the keyboard with a flourish.
He wheeled the monitor around to show Jason a map of the L.A. area, blazing with red splotches that represented unclaimed turf sectors.
"Take your pick, JC boy!"
Now Jason Breckenridge is the manager of Nova Sicilia number 5328 in the Valley. He puts on his smart terracotta blazer every morning and drives to work in his Oldsmobile. Lots of young entrepreneurs would be driving BMWs or Acuras, but the organization of which Jason is now a part of puts a premium on tradition and family values and does not go in for flashy foreign imports.
If an American car is good enough for Uncle Enzo.
Jason's blazer has the Mafia logo embroidered on the breast pocket. A letter G is worked into the logo, signifying Gambino, which is the division that handles accounts for the L.A. Basin. His name is written underneath, Jason, the Iron Pumper, Breckenridge. That is the nickname that he and Mr. Caruso came up with a year ago at the job fair in Illinois. Everyone gets to have a nickname. It is a tradition and a mark of pride, and they like you to pick something that says something about you. As manager of a local office, Jason's job is to portion work out to local contractors. Every morning he parks his Oldsmobile out front and goes into the office, ducking quickly into the armored doorway to foil possible Narcolombian snipers. This does not prevent them from taking occasional pot shots at the big Uncle Enzo that rises up above the franchise. But those signs can take an amazing amount of abuse before they start looking seedy. Safely inside, Jason signs on to TurfNet. A job list scrolls automatically onto the screen. All Jason has to do is find contractors to handle all of those jobs before he goes home that night, or else he has to take care of them himself. One way or another, they have to get done. The great majority of the jobs are simple deliveries, which he portions out to couriers. Then there are collections from delinquent borrowers and from franchisees who depend on Nova Sicilia for their plant security. If it's a first notice, Jason likes to drop by in person just to show the flag, to emphasize that his organization takes a personal, one-to-one, hands-on, micromanaged approach to debt-related issues. If it's a second or third notice, he usually writes a contract with Deadbeaters International, a high-impact collection agency with whose work he has always been very happy. Then there is the occasional Code H. Jason hates to deal with Code H's, views them as symptoms of a breakdown in the system of mutual trust that makes society work. But usually, these are handled directly from the regional level, and all Jason has to do is aftermath management and spin control. This morning, Jason is looking especially crisp, his Oldsmobile freshly waxed and polished. Before he goes inside, he plucks a couple of burger wrappers off the parking lot. Snipers be damned. He has heard that Uncle Enzo is in the area, and you never knew when he might pull his fleet of limousines and war wagons into a neighborhood franchise and pop in to shake hands with the rank and file. Yes, Jason is going to be working late tonight, burning the oil until he receives word that Uncle Enzo's plane is safely out of the area. He signs onto TurfNet. A list of jobs scrolls up as usual, not a very long list. Inter-franchise activity is way down today, as all the local managers gird, polish, and inspect for the possible arrival of Uncle Enzo. But one of the jobs scrolls up in red letters. A priority job. Priority jobs are a little unusual. A symptom of bad morale and general slipshoddity. Every job should be a priority job. But every so often, there is something that absolutely can't be delayed or screwed up. A local manager like Jason can't order up a priority job. It has to come from a higher echelon. Usually a priority job is a code H, but Jason notes with relief that this one is a simple delivery. Certain documents are to be hand-carried from his office to Nova Sicilia number 4649, which is south of downtown. Way south. Compton. A war zone. Longtime stronghold of Narcolombians and Rastafarian gunslingers. Compton. Why the hell would an office in Compton need a personally signed copy of his financial records? They should be spending all their time doing code H's on the competition out there. As a matter of fact, there is a very active young mafia group on a certain block in Compton that has just succeeded in driving away all of the Narcolombians and turning the whole area into a mafia-watch neighborhood. Old ladies are walking the streets again. Children are waiting for school buses and playing hopscotch on sidewalks that recently were stained with blood. It's a fine example. If it can be done on this block, it can be done anywhere. As a matter of fact, Uncle Enzo is coming to congratulate them in person. This afternoon. And number 4649 is going to be his temporary headquarters. The implications are stunning. Jason has been given a priority job to deliver his records to the very franchise where Uncle Enzo will be taking his espresso this afternoon. Uncle Enzo is interested in him. Mr. Caruso claimed he had connections higher up, but could they really go this high? Jason sits back in his color-coordinated earth-tone swivel chair to consider the very real possibility that in a few days he's going to be managing a whole region, or even better. One thing's for sure. This is not a delivery to be entrusted to any courier, any punk on a skateboard. Jason is going to trundle his Oldsmobile into Compton personally to drop this stuff off. He's there an hour ahead of schedule. He was shooting for half an hour early, but once he gets a load of Compton, he's heard stories about the place, of course, but my God, he starts driving like a maniac. Cheap, nasty franchises all tend to adopt logos with a lot of bright, hideous yellow in them, and so Alameda Street is clearly marked out before him, a gout of radioactive urine ejected south from the dead center of L.A. Jason aims himself right down the middle, ignoring lane markings and red lights, and puts the hammer down. Most of the franchises are yellow-logoed, wrong-side-of-the-tracks operations, like Uptown, Narcolombia, Cayman's Plus, Medizania, and The Clink. But standing out like rocky islands in this swamp are the Nova Sicilia franchises, beachheads for the mafia's effort to out-duel the overwhelmingly strong Narcolombia. Shitty lots that even The Clink wouldn't buy always tend to get picked up by economy-minded three-ringers who have just shelled out ¥1,000,000 for a Narcolombia license and who need some real estate, any real estate that they can throw a fence around and extraterritorialize. These local franchises send most of their gross to Medellin in franchising fees and keep barely enough to pay overhead. Some of them try to scam, to sneak a few bills into their pocket when they think the security camera isn't watching, and run down the street to the nearest Cayman's Plus or the Alps Franchelet, which hover in these areas like flies on roadkill. But these people rapidly find out that in Narcolombia, just about everything is a capital offense, and there is no judicial system to speak of,
just flying justice squads that have the right to blow into your franchise at any time of day or night and fax your records back to the notoriously picky computer in Medellin. Nothing sucks more than being hauled in front of a firing squad against the back wall of the business that you built with your own two hands. Uncle Enzo reckons that with the Mafia's emphasis on loyalty and traditional family values, they can sign up a lot of these entrepreneurs before they become Narcolombian citizens. And that explains the billboards that Jason sees with growing frequency as he drives into Compton. The smiling face of Uncle Enzo seems to beam down from every corner. Typically, he's got his arm around the shoulders of a young, wholesome-looking black kid, and there's a catchphrase above.
The Mafia. You've got a friend in the family.
And,
relax. You are entering a Mafia Watch neighborhood.
And,
Uncle Enzo forgives and forgets.
This last one usually accompanies a picture of Uncle Enzo with his arm around some teenager's shoulders, giving him a stern, avuncular talking to. It is an allusion to the fact that the Colombians and Jamaicans kill just about everyone.
No way, Jose!
Uncle Enzo, holding up one hand to stop an Uzi-toting Hispanic scumbag. Behind him stands a pan-ethnic phalanx of kids and grannies resolutely gripping baseball bats and frying pans. Oh, sure, the Narcolombians still have a lock on coca leaves, but now that Nippon Pharmaceuticals has its big cocaine synthesis facility in Mexicali nearly complete, that will cease to be a factor. The Mafia's betting that any smart youngster going into the business these days will take note of these billboards and think twice. Why end up suffocating on your own entrails out in back of some buy-and-fly when you can put on a crisp terracotta blazer instead and become part of a jovial familia? Especially now that they have black, Hispanic, and Asian capos who will respect your cultural identity. In the long term, Jason is bullish on the mob. His black Oldsmobile is a fucking bullseye in a place like this. It's the worst thing he has ever seen, Compton. Lepers roasting dogs on spits over tubs of flaming kerosene. Street people pushing wheelbarrows piled high with dripping clots of million and billion dollar bills that they have raked up out of storm sewers. Roadkills, enormous roadkills. Roadkills so big that they could only be human beings, smeared out into chunky swaths a block long. Burning roadblocks across major avenues. No franchises anywhere. The Oldsmobile keeps popping. Jason can't think of what it is until he realizes that people are shooting at him. Good thing he let his uncle talk him into springing for full armor. When he figures that one out, he actually gets psyched. This is the real thing, man. He's driving around in his Olds and the bastards are shooting at him and it just don't matter. Every street for 3 blocks around the franchise is blocked off by Mafia war wagons. Men lurk on top of burned tenements carrying 6-foot-long rifles and wearing black windbreakers with Mafia across the back in 5-inch fluorescent letters. This is it, man. This is the real shit. Pulling up to the checkpoint, he notes that his Olds is now straddling a portable Claymore mine. If he's the wrong guy, it'll turn the car into a steel donut. But he's not the wrong guy. He's the right guy. He's got a priority job, a heap of documents on the seat next to him, wrapped up tight and pretty. He rolls the window down, and a top echelon Mafia guardsman nails him with the retinal scanner. None of this ID card nonsense. They know who he is in a microsecond. He sits back against his whiplash arrester, turns the rearview mirror to face himself, checks his hairstyle. It's not half bad.
"Bud," the guard says, "you ain't on the list."
"Yes, I am," Jason says. "This is a priority delivery. Got the papers right here." He hands a hard copy of the Turfnet job order to the guard, who looks at it, grunts, and goes into his war wagon, which is richly festooned with antennas. There is a very, very long wait. A man is approaching on foot, walking across the emptiness between the Mafia franchise and the perimeter. The vacant lot is a wilderness of charred bricks and twisted electrical conduit, but this gentleman is walking across it like Christ on the Sea of Galilee.
His suit is perfectly black. So is his hair. He doesn't have any guards with him. The perimeter security is that good. Jason notices that all the guards at this checkpoint are standing a little straighter, adjusting their ties, shooting their cuffs. Jason wants to climb out of his bullet-pocked Oldsmobile to show proper respect to whoever this guy is. But he can't get the door open because a big guard is standing right there, using the roof as a mirror. All too quickly, he's there.
"Is this him?" he says to the guard.
The guard looks at Jason for a couple of seconds, as though he can't quite believe it, then looks at the important man in the black suit and nods. The man in the black suit nods back, tugs on his cuffs a little bit, squints around him for a few moments, looking at the snipers up on the roofs, looking everywhere but at Jason. Then he steps forward one pace. One of his eyes is made of glass and doesn't point in the same direction as the other one. Jason thinks he's looking elsewhere, but he's looking at Jason with his good eye. Or maybe he isn't. Jason can't tell which eye is the real one. He shudders and stiffens like a puppy in a deep freeze.
"Jason Breckenridge," the man says.
"The iron pumper," Jason reminds him.
"Shut up. For the rest of the conversation, you don't say anything. When I tell you what you did wrong, you don't say you're sorry because I already know you're sorry. And when you drive out of here alive, you don't thank me for being alive. And you don't even say goodbye to me."
Jason nods.
"I don't even want you to nod. That's how much you annoy me. Just freeze and shut up. Okay, here we go. We gave you a priority job this morning. It was real easy. All you had to do was read the fucking job sheet. But you didn't read it. You just took it upon yourself to make the fucking delivery on your own, which the job sheet explicitly tells you not to do."
Jason's eyes flick in the direction of the bundle of documents on the seat.
"That's crap," the man says. "We don't want your fucking documents. We don't care about you and your fucking franchise out in the middle of nowhere. All we wanted was the courier. The job sheet said that this delivery was supposed to be made by one particular courier who works your area, name of YT. Uncle Enzo happens to like YT. He wants to meet her. Now, because you screwed up, Uncle Enzo doesn't get his wish. Oh, what a terrible outcome. What an embarrassment. What an incredible fuck-up is what it is. It's too late to save your franchise, Jason the Iron Pumper. But it might not be too late to keep the sewer rats from eating your nipples for dinner."
This wasn't done with a sword, Hero says. He is beyond astonishment as he stands and stares at Lagos' corpse. All the emotions will probably come piling in on him later when he goes home and tries to sleep. For now, the thinking part of his brain seems cut loose from his body, as if he has just ingested a great deal of drugs and he's just as cool as Squeaky.
"Oh yeah? How can you tell?" Squeaky says.
"Swords make quick cuts all the way through. Like, you cut off a head or an arm. A person who's been killed with a sword doesn't look like this."
"Really? Have you killed a lot of people with swords, Mr. Protagonist?"
"Yes. In the metaverse."
They stand for a while longer looking at it.
"This doesn't look like a speed move. This looks like a strength move," Squeaky says.
"Raven looks strong enough."
"That he does.
But I don't think he was carrying a weapon. The Crips frisked him earlier and he was clean."
"Well, then he must have borrowed one," Squeaky says. "This bug was all over the place, you know. We were keeping an eye on him because we were afraid he was going to piss Raven off. He kept going around looking for a vantage point."
"He's loaded with surveillance gear," Hero says. "The higher he gets, the better it works."
"So he ended up here on this embankment? And apparently the perpetrator knew where he was."
"The dust," Hero says. "Watch the lasers."
Down below, Sushike pirouettes spastically as a beer bottle caroms off his forehead. A bundle of lasers sweeps across the embankment, clearly visible in the fine dust being drawn out of it by the wind. This guy, this bug, was using lasers. As soon as he came up here, they betrayed his position, Squeaky says. And then Raven came after him. Well, we're not saying it's him, Squeaky says. But I need to know if this character, he nods at the corpse, might have done anything that would have made Raven feel threatened. What is this, group therapy? Who cares if Raven felt threatened? I do, Squeaky says with great finality. Lagos was just a gargoyle, a big hoover for intel. I don't think he did wet operations, and if he did, he wouldn't do it in that getup. So why do you think Raven was feeling so jumpy? I guess he doesn't like being under surveillance, Hero says. Yeah, Squeaky says. You should remember that. Then Squeaky puts one hand over his ear, the better to hear voices on his headset radio. Did YT see this happen? Hero says. No, Squeaky mumbles a few seconds later. But she saw him leaving the scenes. She's following him. Why would she want to do that? I guess you told her to, or something. I didn't think she'd take off after him. Well, she doesn't know that he killed the guy, Squeaky says. She just phoned in a sighting. He's riding his Harley into Chinatown. And he begins running up the embankment. A couple of enforcers' cars are parked on the shoulder of the highway up there, waiting. Hero tags along. His legs are in incredible shape from sword fighting, and he manages to catch up to Squeaky by the time he reaches his car. When the driver undoes the electric door locks, Hero scoots into the back seat as Squeaky is going into the front. Squeaky turns around and gives him a tired look. I'll behave, Hero says. Just one thing. I know. Don't fuck around with Raven. That's right. Squeaky holds his glare for another second, then turns around, motions the driver to drive. He impatiently rips 10 feet of hard copy out of the dashboard printer and begins sifting through it. On this long strip of paper, Hero glimpses multiple renditions of the important Crip, the guy with the goatee whom Raven was dealing with earlier. On the printout, he is labeled as T-Bone Murphy. There's also a picture of Raven. It's an action shot, not a mug shot. It is terrible output. It has been caught through some kind of light-amplifying optics that wash out the color and make everything incredibly grainy and low contrast. It looks like some image processing has been done to make it sharper. This also makes it grainier. The license plate is just an oblate blur, overwhelmed by the glow of the taillight. It is heeled over sharply, the sidecar wheel several inches off the ground, but the rider doesn't have any visible neck. His head, or rather the dark splotch that is there, just keeps getting wider until it merges into his shoulders. Definitely Raven.
How come you have pictures of T-Bone Murphy in there? Hero says.
He's chasing him, Squeaky says.
Who's chasing whom?
Well, your friend YT ain't no Edward R. Murrow. But as far as we can tell from her reports, they've been sighted in the same area trying to kill each other, Squeaky says.
He's speaking with the slow, distant tones of someone who is getting live updates over his headphones.
They were doing some kind of deal earlier, Hero says.
Then I ain't hardly surprised they're trying to kill each other now.
Once they get to a certain part of town, following the T-Bone and Raven show becomes a matter of connect the ambulances. Every couple of blocks there is a cluster of cops and medics, lights sparkling, radios coughing. All they have to do is go from one to the next. At the first one, there is a dead Crip lying on the pavement. A 6-foot-wide blood slick runs from his body, diagonally down the street to a storm drain. The ambulance people are standing around, smoking and drinking coffee from go-cups, waiting for the enforcers to get finished measuring and photographing so that they can haul the corpse to the morgue. There are no IV lines set up, no bits of medical trash strewn around the area, no open doc boxes. They didn't even try. They proceed around a couple of corners to the next constellation of flashing lights.
Here the ambulance drivers are inflating a cast around the leg of a medicop. Run over by the motorcycle, Squeaky says, shaking his head with the traditional enforcer's disdain for their pathetic junior relations, the medicops. Finally, he patches the radio feed into the dashboard so they can all hear it. The motorcyclist's trail is now cold, and it sounds like most of the local cops are dealing with aftermath problems. But a citizen has just called in to complain that a man on a motorcycle and several other persons are trashing a field of hops on her block.
3 blocks from here, Squeaky says to the driver.
Hops? Hero says.
I know the place. Local microbrewery, Squeaky says. They grow their own hops. Contracted out to some urban gardeners. Chinese peasants who do the grunt work for them.
When they arrive, the first authority figures on the scene, it is obvious why Raven decided to let himself get chased into a hop field. It is great cover. The hops are heavy flowering vines that grow on trellises lashed together out of long bamboo poles. The trellises are 8 feet high. You can't see a thing. They all get out of the car.
T-Bone! Squeaky hollers.
They hear someone yelling in English from the middle of the field.
Over here!
But he isn't responding to Squeaky. They walk into the hop field, carefully. There is an enveloping smell, a resiny odor not unlike marijuana, the sharp smell that comes off an expensive beer. Squeaky motions for Hero to stay behind him. In other circumstances, Hero would do so. He is half Japanese, and under certain circumstances, totally respectful of authority. This is not one of those circumstances. If Raven comes anywhere near Hero, Hero is going to be talking to him with his katana. And if it comes to that, Hero doesn't want Squeaky anywhere near him because he could lose a limb on the backswing.
Yo, T-Bone! Squeaky yells. It's the enforcers and we're pissed! Get the fuck out of there, man! Let's go home!
T-Bone, or Hero assumes it is T-Bone, responds only by firing a short burst from a machine pistol. The muzzle flash lights up the hop vines like a strobe light. Hero aims one shoulder at the ground, buries himself in soft earth and foliage for a few seconds.
Fuck!
T-Bone says. It's a disappointed fuck, but a fuck with a heavy undertone of overwhelming frustration and not a little fear. Hero gets up into a conservative squat, looks around. Squeaky and the other enforcer are nowhere to be seen. Hero forces his way through one of the trellises and into a row that is closer to the action. The other enforcer, the driver, is in the same row, about 10 meters away, his back turned to Hero. He glances over his shoulder in Hero's direction, then looks in the other direction and sees someone else. Hero can't quite see who, because the enforcer is in the way. What the fuck? The enforcer says. Then he jumps a little, as though startled, and something happens to the back of his jacket.
Who is it?
Hero says. The enforcer doesn't say anything. He is trying to turn back around, but something prevents it. Something is shaking the vines around him. The enforcer shudders, careens sideways from foot to foot.
Gotta get loose,
he says, speaking loudly to no one in particular. He breaks into a trot, running away from Hero. The other person who was in the row is gone now. The enforcer is running in a strange, stiff, upright gait with his arms down to his sides. His bright green windbreaker isn't hanging correctly. Hero runs after him. The enforcer is trotting toward the end of the row, where the lights of the street are visible. The enforcer exits the field a couple of seconds ahead of him, and when Hero gets to the curb, is in the middle of the road, illuminated mostly by flashing blue light from a giant overhead video screen. He is turning around and around with strange little stomping footsteps, not keeping his balance very well. He is saying, in a low, calm voice that gurgles, as though he badly needs to clear his throat. As the enforcer revolves, Hero perceives that he has been impaled on an 8-foot-long bamboo spear. Half sticks out the front, half out the back. The back half is dark with blood and black fecal clumps. The front half is greenish-yellow and clean. The enforcer can only see the front half, and his hands are playing up and down it, trying to verify what his eyes are seeing. Then the back half whacks into a parked car, spraying a narrow fan of head cheese across the waxed and polished trunk lid. The car's alarm goes off. The enforcer hears the sound and turns around to see what it is. When Hiro last sees him, he is running down the center of the pulsating neon street toward the center of Chinatown, wailing a terrible random song that clashes with the bleating of the car alarm. Hiro feels even at this moment that something has been torn open in the world and that he is dangling above the gap, staring into a place where he does not want to be, lost in the biomass. Hiro draws his katana.
Squeaky! Hiro hollers. He's throwing spears! He's pretty good at it! Your driver is hit!
Got it! Squeaky hollers.
Hiro goes back into the closest row. He hears a sound off to the right and uses the katana to cut his way through into that row. This is not a nice place to be at the moment, but it is safer than standing in the street under the platonic light of the video screen. Down the row is a man. Hiro recognizes him by the strange shape of his head, which just gets wider until it reaches his shoulders. He is holding a freshly cut bamboo pole in one hand, torn from the trellis. Raven strokes one end of it with his other hand, and a chunk falls off. Something flickers in that hand, the blade of a knife, apparently. He has just cut off the end of the pole at an acute angle to make it into a spear. He throws it fluidly. The motion is calm and beautiful. The spear disappears because it is coming straight at Hiro. Hiro does not have time to adopt the proper stance, but this is fine since he has already adopted it. Whenever he has a katana in his hands, he adopts it automatically. Otherwise, he fears that he may lose his balance and carelessly lop off one of his extremities. Feet parallel and pointed straight ahead, right foot in front of the left foot, katana held down at groin level like an extension of the phallus. Hiro raises the tip and slaps at the spear with the side of the blade, diverting it just enough. It goes into a slow sideways spin, the point missing Hiro just barely and entangling itself in a vine on Hiro's right. The butt end swings around and gets hung up on the left, tearing out a number of vines as it comes to a stop. It is heavy and traveling very fast. Raven is gone. Mental note. Whether or not Raven intended to take on a bunch of Crips and Enforcers single-handedly tonight, he didn't even bother to pack a gun. Another burst of gunfire sounds from several rows over. Hiro has been standing here for rather a long time, thinking about what just happened. He cuts through the next row of vines and heads in the direction of the muzzle flash, running his mouth.
Don't shoot this way, T-Bone! I'm on your side, man!
Motherfucker threw a stick into my chest, man!
T-Bone complains. When you're wearing armor, getting hit by a spear just isn't such a big deal anymore.
Maybe you should just forget it, Hiro says.
He is having to cut his way through a lot of rows to reach T-Bone, but as long as T-Bone keeps talking, Hiro can find him.
I'm a Crip. We don't forget nothing, T-Bone says. Is that you?
No, Hiro says. I'm not there yet.
A very brief burst of gunfire, rapidly cut off. Suddenly, no one is talking. Hiro cuts his way into the next row and almost steps on T-Bone's hand, which has been amputated at the wrist. Its finger is still tangled in the trigger guard of a Mac 11. The remainder of T-Bone is two rows away. Hiro stops and watches through the vines. Raven is one of the largest men Hiro has seen outside of a professional sporting event. T-Bone is backing away from him down the row. Raven, moving with long, confident strides, catches up with T-Bone and swings one hand up into T-Bone's body. Hiro doesn't have to see the knife to know it is there. It looks as though T-Bone is going to get out of this with nothing worse than a sewn-on hand and some rehab work, because you can't stab a person to death that way, not if he is wearing armor. T-Bone screams. He is bouncing up and down on Raven's hand. The knife has gone all the way through the bulletproof fabric, and now Raven is trying to gut T-Bone the same way he did Lagos. But his knife, whatever the hell it is, won't cut through the fabric that way. It is sharp enough to penetrate, which should be impossible, but not sharp enough to slash. Raven pulls it out, drops to one knee, and swings his knife hand around in a long ellipse between T-Bone's thighs. Then he jumps over T-Bone's collapsing body and runs. Hero gets the sense that T-Bone is a dead man, so he follows Raven. His intention is not to hunt the man down, but rather to maintain a very clear picture of where he is. He has to cut through a number of rows. He rapidly loses Raven. He considers running as fast as he can in the opposite direction. Then he hears the deep, lung-stretching rumble of a motorcycle engine. Hero runs for the nearest street exit, just hoping to catch a glimpse. He does, though it is a quick one, not a hell of a lot better than the graphic in the cop car. Raven turns to look at Hero just as he is blowing out of there. He's right under a street light, so Hero gets a clear look at his face for the first time. He is Asian. He has a wispy mustache that trails down past his chin. Another Crip comes running out into the street half a second after Hero as Raven is pulling away. He slows for a moment to take stock of the situation, then charges the motorcycle like a linebacker. He is crying out as he does so, a war cry. Squeaky emerges about the same time as the Crip, starts chasing both of them down the street. Raven seems to be unaware of the Crip running behind him, but in hindsight, it seems apparent that he has been watching his approach in the rearview mirror of the motorcycle. As the Crip comes in range, Raven's hand lets go of the throttle for a moment, snaps back as if he is throwing away a piece of litter. His fist strikes the middle of the Crip's face like a frozen ham shot out of a cannon. The Crip's head snaps back. His feet are lifted off the ground. He does most of a backflip and strikes the pavement, hitting first with the nape of his neck, both arms slamming out straight onto the road as he does so. It looks a lot like a controlled fall, though if so, it has to be more reflex than anything. Squeaky decelerates, turns and kneels down next to the fallen Crip, ignoring Raven. Hero watches the large, radioactive, spear-throwing killer drug lord ride his motorcycle into Chinatown, which is the same as riding into China, as far as chasing him down is concerned. He runs up to the Crip, who is lying crucified in the center of the street. The lower half of the Crip's face is pretty hard to make out. His eyes are half open, and he looks quite relaxed. He speaks quietly. He's a fucking Indian or something. Interesting idea, but Hero still thinks he's Asian.
What the fuck did you think you were doing, asshole? Squeaky says.
He sounds so pissed that Hero steps away from him.
That fucker ripped us off. The suitcase burned,
the Crip mumbles through a mashed jaw.
So why didn't you just write it off? Are you crazy, fucking with Raven like that?
He ripped us off. Nobody does that and lives.
Well, Raven just did, Squeaky says. Finally, he's calming down a little. He rocks back on his heels, looks up at Hero.
T-Bone and your driver are not likely to be alive, Hero says. This guy better not move. He could have a neck fracture.
He's lucky I don't fracture his fucking neck, Squeaky says.
The ambulance people get there fast enough to slap an inflatable cervical collar around the Crip's neck before he gets ambitious enough to stand up. They haul him away within a few minutes. Hero goes back into the hops and finds T-Bone. T-Bone is dead, slumped in a kneeling position against the trellis. The stab wound through his bulletproof vest probably would have been fatal, but Raven wasn't satisfied with that. He went down low and slashed up and down the insides of T-Bone's thighs, which are now laid open all the way to the bone. In doing so, he put great lengthwise rents into both of T-Bone's femoral arteries, and his entire blood supply dropped out of him, like slicing the bottom off a styrofoam cup. Twenty. The enforcers turned the entire block into a mobile cop headquarters, with cars and paddy wagons and satellite links and flatbed trucks. Dudes with white coats are walking up and down through the hop field with Geiger counters. Squeaky is wandering around with his headset, staring into space, carrying on conversations with people who aren't there. A tow truck shows up, towing T-Bone's black BMW behind it.
Yo, Pod!
Hero turns around and looks. It's YT. She's just come out of a Hunan place across the street. She hands Hero a little white box and a pair of chopsticks.
Spicy chicken with black bean sauce, no MSG. You know how to use chopsticks?
Hero shrugs off this insult.
I got a double order, YT continues. 'Cause I figure we got some good intel tonight.
Are you aware of what happened here?
No. I mean, some people obviously got hurt.
But you weren't an eyewitness.
No, I couldn't keep up with them.
That's good, Hero says.
What did happen?
Hero just shakes his head. The spicy chicken is glistening darkly under the lights. He has never been less hungry in his life.
If I had known, I wouldn't have gotten you involved. I just thought it was a surveillance job.
What happened?
I don't want to get into it. Look, stay away from Raven, okay?
Sure, she says.
She says it in the chirpy tone of voice that she uses when she's lying and she wants to make sure you know it. Squeaky hauls open the back door of the BMW and looks into the back seat. Hero steps a little closer, gets a nasty whiff of cold smoke. It is the smell of burnt plastic. The aluminum briefcase that Raven earlier gave to T-Bone is sitting in the middle of the seat. It looks like it has been thrown into a fire. It has black smoke stains splaying out around the locks, and its plastic handle is partially melted. The buttery leather that covers the BMW's seats has burn marks on it. No wonder T-Bone was pissed. Squeaky pulls on a pair of latex gloves. He hauls the briefcase out, sets it on the trunk lid, and rips the latches open with a small pry bar. Whatever it is complicated and highly designed. The top half of the case has several rows of the small red-capped tubes that Hero saw at the U storage. There are 5 rows, with maybe 20 tubes in each row. The bottom half of the case appears to be some kind of miniaturized, old-fashioned computer terminal. Most of it is occupied by a keyboard. There is a small liquid crystal display screen that can probably handle about 5 lines of text at a time. There is a pen-like object attached to the case by a cable, maybe 3 feet long, uncoiled. It looks like it might be a light pen or a barcode scanner. Above the keyboard is a lens, set at an angle so that it is aimed at whoever is typing on the keyboard. There are other features whose purpose is not so obvious. A slot, which might be a place to insert a credit or ID card, and a cylindrical socket that is about the size of one of those little tubes. This is Hero's reconstruction of how the thing looked at one time. When Hero sees it, it is melted together, judging from the pattern of smoke marks on the outside of the case, which appear to be jetting outward from the crack between the top and bottom. The source of the flame was inside, not outside. Squeaky reaches down and unsnaps one of the tubes from the bracket, holds it up in front of the bright lights of Chinatown. It had been transparent, but was now smirched by heat and smoke. From a distance, it looks like a simple vial, but stepping up to look at it more closely, Hero can see at least 6 tiny individual compartments inside the thing, all connected to each other by capillary tubes. It has a red plastic cap on one end of it. The cap has a black rectangular window, and as Squeaky rotates it, Hero can see the dark red glint of an inactive LED display inside, like looking at the display on a turned-off calculator. Underneath this is a small perforation. It isn't just a simple drilled hole. It is wide at the surface, rapidly narrowing to a nearly invisible pinpoint opening, like the bell of a trumpet. The compartments inside the vial are all partially filled with liquids. Some of them are transparent and some are blackish brown. The brown ones have to be organics of some kind, now reduced by the heat in the chicken soup. The transparent ones could be anything.
He got out to go into a bar and have a drink, Squeaky mumbles. What an asshole. Who did?
T-Bone.
See, T-Bone was like the registered owner of this unit, the suitcase. And as soon as he got more than about 10 feet away from it, foosh, it self-destructed. Why?
Squeaky looks at Hero like he's stupid.
Well, it's not like I work for Central Intelligence or anything. But I would guess that whoever makes this drug, they call it Countdown or Red Cap or Snow Crash, has a real thing about trade secrets. So if the pusher abandons the suitcase or loses it or tries to transfer ownership to someone else, boosh.
You think the Crips are going to catch up with Raven?
Not in Chinatown. Shit, Squeaky says, getting pissed again in retrospect. I can't believe that guy. I could have killed him.
Raven?
No, that Crip chasing Raven. He's lucky Raven got to him first, not me.
You were chasing the Crip?
Yeah, I was chasing the Crip. What? Did you think I was trying to catch Raven?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, he's the bad guy, right?
Definitely. So I'd be chasing Raven if I was a cop and it was my job to catch bad guys. But I'm an enforcer, and it's my job to enforce order. So I'm doing everything I can, and so is every other enforcer in town, to protect Raven. And if you have any ideas about trying to go and find Raven yourself and get revenge for that colleague of yours that he offed, you can forget it.
Offed? What colleague?
YT breaks in. She didn't see what happened with Lagos. Hero is mortified by this idea.
Is that why everyone was telling me not to fuck with Raven? They were afraid I was going to attack him?
Squeaky eyes the swords.
You got the means. Why should anyone protect Raven?
Squeaky smiles as though he has just crossed the border into the realm of kidding around.
He's a sovereign. So declare war on him.
It's not a good idea to declare war on a nuclear power.
Huh? Christ, Squeaky says, shaking his head. If I had any idea how little you knew about this shit, I would never let you into my car. I thought you were some kind of a serious CIC wet operations guy. Are you telling me you really didn't know about Raven?
Yes, that's what I'm telling you.
Okay. I'm gonna tell you this so you don't go out and cause any more trouble. Raven's packing a torpedo warhead that he boosted from an old Soviet nuke sub. It was a torpedo that was designed to take out a carrier battle group with one shot. A nuclear torpedo. You know that funny-looking sidecar that Raven has on his Harley? Well, it's a hydrogen bomb, man. Armed and ready. The trigger's hooked up to EEG trodes embedded in his skull. If Raven dies, the bomb goes off. So when Raven comes into town, we do everything in our power to make the man feel welcome.
Hero's just gaping. YT has to step in on his behalf.
Okay, she says. Speaking for my partner and myself, we'll stay away from him.
YT reckons she's going to spend all afternoon being a ramp turd. The surf is always up on the Harbor Freeway, which gets her from downtown into Compton, but the off-ramps into that neighborhood are so rarely used that 3-foot tumbleweeds grow in their potholes. And she's definitely not going to travel into Compton under her own power. She wants to poon something big and fast. She can't use the standard trick of ordering a pizza to her destination and then pooning the delivery boy as he roars past, because none of the pizza chains deliver to this neighborhood. So she'll have to stop at the off-ramp and wait hours and hours for a ride. A ramp turd. She does not want to do this delivery at all, but the franchisee wants her to do it bad. Really bad. The amount of money he has offered her is so high, it's stupid. The package must be full of some kind of intense new drug. But that's not as weird as what happens next. She is cruising down the harbor freeway, approaching the desired off-ramp, having pooned a southbound semi. A quarter mile from the off-ramp, a bullet-pocked black Oldsmobile cruises past her, right turn signal flashing. He's going to exit.